It's Wednesday. It's 1 o'clock. It's time for the Indie Media Radio London show, brought to you on Resonance FM 104.4, bringing protest stories direct from the streets, posted onto the indiemedia.org.uk newswire and to global indie media sites worldwide. We look forward to presenting your stories, so keep posting them to indiemedia.org.uk.
Hello, good afternoon. It's 1 o'clock. It's Wednesday, the 29th of March, 2006, and this is the London Indie Media Newswire. It's a lovely sunny day out there, and a very special show today. We've got some lovely clowns with us. We've got Sam, and hopefully later on we've got Arthur Neslin, who's talking about his new book about Israel. But first, to a story. This week in Scotland, 50 protesters, including asylum seekers, church ministers and charity workers, gave Tony McNulty, the Minister of State for Immigration and Citizenship, a loud message when they demonstrated outside a press conference he was holding. Campaigners accuse him of refusing to end the shocking practice of dawn raids on families who are to be deported. Protesters booed the immigration minister as he went to his car outside the Radisson's Hotel in Glasgow after the press conference. They then followed McNulty to the city chambers in Glasgow, where he met council officials to discuss the proposed housing contracts for dispersed asylum seekers. Around 150 protesters then waited at the city chambers for Mr. McNulty, who refused to come out of the main entrance when he saw the strength of feeling amongst the crowds. Trying to slip out unnoticed from another exit, he was unable to leave for 20 minutes while protesters blockaded the side exit to the chambers. Rabina Qureshi, Director of Positive Action in Housing, said, "It's a pity because all we wanted to ask him was why he won't stop dawn raids and why he insists on making asylum seekers destitute on the streets of Glasgow when they have nowhere else to go in this world. I don't think he has the heart to even answer that question, so he was trapped like a rat in a tunnel by the protesters and got the send-off he deserved. For more, see Scotland.indiemedia.org. And now I believe we're going to have a song from Sam, and he's not going to talk about deportation, though he's got many songs.
It's too nice a day. As we've got April Fools and we've got some clowns in today, I'm going to do a nice jovial song, which is comes from the old beliefs of transmogrification and changing into animals, and it's a very sort of romantic song about sex, really. And it's called Hares on the Mountain. If maidens could run like hares on the mountain, if maidens could run like hares on the mountain, how many young men would take horses right after sing fal-a-ral, fal-a-ral, fal-a-ral all day? Hell, if maidens could sing like blackbirds and thrushes, if maidens could sing like blackbirds and thrushes, how many young men would jump in them bushes, sing fal-a-ral, fal-a-ral, fal-a-ral all day? And if women could grow like lilies and rushes, if women could grow like lilies and rushes, how many young men would take sides and cut rushes, sing fal-a-ral, fal-a-ral, fal-a-ral all day? And if maidens could swim like fish in the river, if maidens could swim like fish in the river, how many young men would dive in right after, sing fal-a-ral, fal-a-ral, fal-a-ral day?
Well, now, talking about coming up this weekend in Parliament Square, from, as you know, the probably if you listen regularly to the show, from the 1st of August 2005, there's been an act called Section 132 of the Serious Organised Crime and Police Act, or SOCPA, which has made exercising rights to free expression and association in a 1 kilometre exclusion zone around Westminster a criminal act. As a result of this no-protest zone, campaigners have shown a determination to defy this undemocratic law through a variety of peaceful means. Campaigners say the government's introduction of an exclusion zone around Westminster is just part of a wider programme of repressive and authoritarian measures, including ID cards, ASBOs, the Legislative and Regulatory Reform Bill, and detention without trial. So this Saturday, we'll see an April Fool's Day-themed demonstration against the no-protest exclusion zone. April Fool's Day was the traditional New Year's Day and the climax of the lost tradition of European Carnivali, the day when the commoner could safely speak the truth to the all-powerful, a reversal of traditional societal rules, culminating with the crowning of the wise, humble servant and the condemnation of the truly foolish king. And in the studio to discuss the history and ideas behind this action on Saturday. We've got Private Dandelion, Major Pantsway, and Commodore Coogie of the clandestine insurgent Rebel Clown Army. Mm. So, tell us, first of all, perhaps Commodore Coogie, should I address the most senior senior clown present? What's it all about then?
What's it all about? Well, I mean, it's an old tradition, really. And basically, April Fool's Day was meant to turn everything on its head. And historically, what jesters and fools would do would just change the normal order of things. So, you know, the kings and the queens and the clergy and all the authority figures, just for this one day, and everybody would agree that those people would be kind of bought, their status would be reduced to that of commoners, and the status of commoners could be raised on high to that of kings and queens, and basically, you know, as a fool you can be anything, and what it's about is about, you know, endless possibility, really. The possibility of you can be anything you imagine, you know. And fools also resist definitions. So, you know, you're neither a man or a woman, you're not a child, you're not an adult, you're something in between, you know. And you know, this kind of relates to the whole SOCPA thing, in that, you know, people are trying to define what protest is, or, you know, the police is trying, you know, been given the power to define protest, and, you know, and we're playing with that. We're saying that, you know, it is, you know, as fools you can, we can't be put into
okay. So, but I mean, one of the things I think about English culture particularly is the dread people have of being thought a fool. I mean, yeah. As someone who might potentially join you at midday on Saturday down by the London Eye, I feel a certain trepidation or reservation about being a fool. Private Dandelion, don't you feel any embarrassment about going out on the street and saying, hey, I'm a fool?
No, I can actually feel my juices are kind of bubbling up, especially after that lovely song, actually, that gave me a real hit with the fal-de-lals. And, you know, I mean, I think it's really about getting into the feeling of springtime. And it's no coincidence that it's just around the equinox time, you know, when all the birds and bees are coming out to greet us, and here we are just celebrating ourselves, celebrating life. And of course we have to send up authority, and authority cannot hold its authority unless there's some way that we can actually be playful and challenge that authority. Otherwise we'll go away and grumble and be depressed and be unhappy. And so this is a way of promoting true democracy, I think, is to juice it up and exchange our energies and dance. And we invite all those lovely police constables and police constablesses to come and throw flowers at us.
When you're talking about the reaction of the police to these events, how do they react to clownish and fooling behaviour? Is that something that's a problem for them?
Poor things. I think they need some training and advice on how to respond. And I'm sure, I can just imagine them having conferences, you know, as we speak, looking very, very worried. How are they going to respond to, and we hope lots of children come, by the way, to help us with this foolery. How are they going to respond to, you know, a band of clowns making happiness?
Mm. Mm. I mean, I think they want to play as well, really. Mm. You know, they just have to, you know that they are allowed to play as well.
We invite them.
We invite them, yeah.
Because there has been quite a lot going on in Parliament Square. There have been these picnics every Sunday and so on. And I understand that the police are rather reluctant to administer the law, perhaps, as it was legislated. Is that a fair comment? Or?
Yes. but it's been quite arbitrary who they arrest and for what reasons. And it's, you know, it's like they're defining what a protest is, you know. And we did a video, you know, demonstrations in Parliament Square. We were demonstrating things like roly-polies and eating a banana and things like that. Basically, just playing around the idea of what is a demonstration, you know, what is a protest. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a really kind of creative thing. It comes from the community, it comes from the people. And it can't be defined by bureaucrats, you know, and it can't be defined by the law, because, you know, you can't ask the state for permission to protest against the state.
I think it's our sacred right, you know, and we've realised that Parliament, the word parley means to speak, and this is the place that traditionally has been used. And also we've realised that the place where we're going to begin, which is under the Ferris wheel, the festival eye, is a traditional place for fairs and merriment, because it wasn't able to be built on, and somebody came to see me yesterday and said that's a traditional fairground. So we're beginning at just the right place, and then we shall go to the place where you speak out, and we shall declare ourselves. What shall we declare ourselves to?
Lords and ladies and weirdos of misrule.
And there are quite a lot of other things going on that day. I think later on in the day is going to be some magic making in the square. Is that right? And I think also the fairies meeting at Eros.
That's right.
Their sap must be rising too.
Oh, yes. The fairies are out as well in a fairy maid. And we're not sure exactly.
And everyone's invited to come and do their thing, you know, just spontaneously. That's the spirit of carnival. Yeah.
Come out and fool in fairyland.
Yeah, and we're encouraging everybody to play and to fool and to be disobedient and to
claim our traditions,
because this is truly
our tradition.
And our spaces, our land, you know, common land.
Now, it's a controversial point, but the thing is actually predicted to be set off at 12 noon. When I was at school, the teacher said that any April Fool's activities that happened after 12... proved that you were a fool, but I understand you want to reclaim the whole day. Isn't that a bit extravagant?
And also the wise fool is, we must note that we are the wise fools, because we see very deeply what is at risk, that we are challenging the way that democracy is being eroded. And so we've got a very clear intent to challenge, and it takes a lot of wisdom and insight to do that. So we are transforming into the wise fools at midday.
Right.
And again, the fact it was your teacher that said that, I think, maybe proves our point of challenging authority, including the authority of your teacher and his or her domination over you as a child. And it's our inner children, our foolish selves, that are coming out to play. We have this inside. Everyone has this inside all of us. And so we invite everyone in London, the world, to come out and play on April Fool's Day. Reclaim it, it's ours. You know, and for one half day, one day in your life, come out and be foolish. Allow yourself to laugh at yourself. Allow yourself to laugh. I invite the police also to step outside their uniform selves and see, we see the human beings inside. We can make them laugh, and they laugh despite themselves. So we invite the police and everyone in the authority as well, just to take a day off, take a day out of their usual selves, and come and laugh and play on the streets with us.
That's really nice. And if you do that, I believe that later on there's also an after party, a fundraiser for People in Common, who are the group campaigning against the SOCPA legislation. And that's from 7 p.m. to 2 a.m. at the Square Occupied Social Centre, which is at 21 Russell Square.
It's in the northwest side of Russell Square, because it's quite a big square.
Excellent. On Sunday the 2nd, there's the second anniversary of the April 2004 siege of Fallujah. There's a mass civil disobedience protest in Parliament Square to remember the Iraqi dead and demonstrate against the occupation of Iraq. The protest does not have permission, is yet another challenge to the SOCPA legislation. On the 2nd of April 2004, US forces sealed off the Iraqi city of Fallujah in what became the first of two major assaults on the city. At least 572 civilians, including over 300 women and children, were killed in the subsequent siege, according to rememberfallujah.org. Fighter bombers were used to attack residential areas, US snipers targeted ambulances, and at least one US battalion had orders to shoot any male of military age on the streets after dark, armed or not. On Sunday, hundreds of peace activists are expected to attend the unauthorized protest, including Joe Wilding, who personally witnessed US war crimes in Fallujah 2 years ago, and Maya Evans, who last December became the first person to be convicted of participating in an unauthorized demonstration within the no-protest zone. As said, this event doesn't have permission, and in preparation, campaigners are holding a non-violent direct action workshop and legal briefing on Saturday. For more on that, see seedsforchange.org.uk. And for more on the actual protest itself, see j-n-v.org and voicesuk.org. It's also worth noting that peace activist Milan Rai has become the first person to be charged with organising an unauthorised demonstration within the exclusion zone. He was in court on the 17th of March, and a verdict is expected on April the 12th. Whilst this Friday also sees the trial of activist Mark Barrett, who's charged with taking part in an unauthorised protest in Parliament Square. For info on the trials, as well as the whole no protest zone and the campaigns against it, see peopleincommon.org.
And a different tuning. Standard tuning.
Track two, it's from an album called Ballad of the Fallen, and it's Charlie Hayden and Carla Bley and many other fantastic American blowers.
Thank you.
Staying with an anti-war theme, large protests are expected this weekend against the UK visit of Condoleezza Rice. A recent resolution passed by the Northwest TUC annual conference said Ms. Rice had been involved in every stage of the Iraq war, in which thousands of Iraqis have died. The resolution added, she has their blood on her hands. Condoleezza was invited by Jack Straw and will visit Liverpool before heading to the Foreign Secretary's constituency in Blackburn, Lancashire. The website, condiwatch.co.uk, details two protests, one in Liverpool on Friday, where protesters will march to the Philharmonic Hall, where Condoleezza will be the guest of honour at a special performance by the Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra. There's already been some hitches to the visit. Members of the orchestra have refused to play for her visit, and Roger McGough, due to compere the event, has withdrawn his support. Hooray! Attempts to pay other celebrities £500 to host the night have also failed, with actress Kathy Tyson turning down the offer. A member of the Merseyside Stop the War Coalition said, I plead with the people of this great city to shun Condoleezza Rice, who has been central to these events. We would show our true Scouse heart, which is one of love, peace and solidarity. Following the Friday protest in Liverpool, there's a protest scheduled in Blackburn to unwelcome her visit on the Saturday. For more, see condiwatch.co.uk.
And a different tuning.
When she sat down in the dirt in front of your machine, a lovely woman dressed in red, you in military green. If you had met her in Jerusalem, you might have asked her on a date. But here you were in Gaza, rolling towards the gate. As your foot went to the floor, did you recall her eyes? Did her gaze remind you that you've become what you despise? As you rolled on towards this woman and ignored all shouts to stop, did you feel a shred of doubt as you watched her body drop? As your caterpillar tracks upon her body pressed with 60 tons of deadly force, crush the bones within her chest, could you feel the contours of her face as you took her life away? Did you serve your country well on that cool spring day? Back across the green line, back to the open shore. Was this just another day in a dirty war? When you looked out on the water, did you feel an empty void? Or was it just one more life you've taken, one more home destroyed? One more home destroyed.
Now, that was David Rovix singing his song, A Testimony to the Life of... Oh, my God, her name's gone right out of my head.
Rachel Corrie.
Today is the day, actually, that another presenter of this show, Penny, has gone out to Israel and to Palestine to be an ISM observer. And also, in the zeitgeist this week, we have Arthur Neslin with us. Very lucky to have him here today. He's just published a book this week called Occupied Minds, A Journey Through the Israeli Psyche. So, Arthur, first of all, can I say how much I enjoyed reading your book?
You can, thanks.
I really liked, you mentioned to me that you were doing it in the style of Studs Terkel. It's a series of interviews with key players and ordinary Israelis about the state of Israel and what their lives are like now and their histories.
I could say a little bit about
please
that.
Please do.
I like the idea of what Studs Terkel did, which was to try and take the journalist out of journalism to some extent, so that the journalist becomes a facilitator, a mediator who allows people to speak in their own voices and tell their own stories and their own histories. With the story of Israel and of Israeli identity, I thought it was particularly important because the whole way in which the narratives are presented have become so visceral and so emotionally charged, and there are so many false accusations which are levelled at people who argue against the occupation. I thought that in many ways the best weapon to use against that style of arguing was a mirror. And in effect, that's what I was trying to do. It was a Don Quixote strategy.
Well, it's certainly come out. It's very readable, very personal accounts. I'm very interested. How did you line up the series? I mean, there must be about 30 or 40 characters in your book.
There's 50. It varied. Some of them I plucked out of phone books. Some of them were people who I knew I wanted to interview before I even arrived in Israel. Some of them, it came through a very long process of research and then negotiation, often through friends. Sometimes a lot of interviews didn't actually pan out in the end. I had, for example, two interviews lined up with protagonists in the Lavon affair in Egypt, which was a rather dark affair in Israel's history, when two people were hanged, but a number of Egyptian Jews were hired by the Mossad to plant bombs in various centres in Cairo as a means of trying to provoke a flight of Egyptian Jews to Israel. Eventually, Israel initially denied that this had happened. Eventually, it was revealed, and the foreign minister, Pinchas Lavon, had to resign. I did have two interviews arranged with two of the Egyptian Jews who had been hired by Mossad and were then thrown to the wolves and went to prison for approximately 10 years or so. But both of them pulled out within half an hour. After having agreed a month beforehand, within half an hour, both of them suddenly pulled out of interviews, which suggests that it's not always easy to get the interviews you want.
You also tell the story of a man who said he was in Mossad in Baghdad in 1949 or so.
1951,
who, when they were trying to get Jews to leave their residence and go to Israel to found the Jewish state, set off a few bombs to heighten the atmosphere of fear around us. Now, I was shocked when I read that. Is that all that true stuff?
Well, what there is there is his account. Now, Mossad's motto is, by way of deception shalt thou do war, so take everything he says with a pinch of salt. He was convicted in Baghdad of having bombed the Masoud Hashem Tov synagogue. One Jew died in that bombing. In the following days, 10,000 Jews left Iraq to go to Israel. Israel at that time had a desperate need, A, for legitimacy, which Mizrahi immigrants arriving in Israel would provide, B, for labourers. That expelled between 700 and 900,000 Palestinians in the war of 1948, and they needed a working class. Arab Jews were being redefined within Zionist narrative as a working class, as the quantity element of the new Jewish state, whereas the quality element were the European Ashkenazi Jews, and there was a need to bring the Iraqi Jews over. Now, Yehuda Tajar, the Mossad agent who I interviewed, denies having personally planted the bomb, although he was convicted of it. What he reveals in the book for the first time is that other Mossad agents did throw bombs. He claims they did so to try and prove his innocence after he'd been arrested, as that would have shown that he couldn't have been throwing them himself. He also goes on to say, however, that knowing what he now knows, he wouldn't have hesitated to have planted bombs, not in order to kill Iraqi Jews, but to have made them flee the country.
And there
is one other thing I'd quickly say just on the issue of terror, because it's often neglected in the history books that Israel is actually a state that was founded on terror. The Irgun particularly, for example, bombed the King David Hotel, killing 91 civilians. That was one of their biggest atrocities, including a lot of British people, but it was mainly civilians they killed. In Deir Yassin, they killed 250 innocent Arab people, Palestinians. Their butchery was renowned and played a major part in provoking the flight of Palestinians from the land. And the effects of it live on today, because when you see on the news that Ehud Olmert has just been re-elected with his deputy Tzipi Livni, who were their parents? Their parents were very senior officials in the Irgun, both of them, both Tzipi Livni, the deputy prime minister, and Ehud Olmert. That's where they're coming from. When Jonathan Friedland says in The Guardian, revisionist Zionism is dead, he's wrong. Revisionist Zionism is now in power.
So You paint a picture with the interviews from people from different parts of Israeli society, a very divided society. You have very Orthodox Jews, you have settlers, you have ex-security people, you have soldiers, all there with their voices speaking from the pages of your book. Do you see any hope for the future, that the divisions can be resolved? I mean, it struck me as very interesting how divided the Israeli Jews were, never mind the kind of fundamental division from the Palestinians who they displaced back then. Do you see any grounds for optimism?
Well, you always have to try and find grounds for optimism. For me, the grounds for optimism are things like what's happening in Berlin, where you have Israeli peace activists joining and fighting with Palestinians as equals against the system which they feel and rightly feel oppresses both of them. One of the people I interviewed in my book, Matan Cohen, a 17-year-old peace activist, I thought was perhaps the most profoundly hopeful of all my interviewees. However, as you may have heard, 3 weeks ago in Beit Sira, he was shot in the head at point-blank range with a plastic bullet from 10 yards and may now live and almost certainly will lose sight in one eye as a result.
We did telephone interview with him.
He's a very intelligent
And even in your book, he expresses his desire just to get out, doesn't he?
Well, maybe this is perhaps one of the optimistic things. I think amongst the younger generation of Israelis today, there is a real frustration with the Matzav, with the war. There's a real desire for normalization, to become a secular Western country like all other countries. They don't have any means or understanding of the steps which are necessary to bring that about. But at the same time, insofar as Yerida, emigrating, is now a bigger phenomenon than making Aliyah, immigrating to Israel, that sort of hints at a possible normalization in the region. I actually ended the book on the Sinai beach with some hippies and peacenik guys who were just sitting around smoking, playing guitar with Egyptians and Sudanese and Lebanese, and some of them were religious, some of them weren't. The point was that they saw everyone else as an equal, and they felt a part of the region as equals and not as a superior colonial state.
Great. Can we have just a short reading? I particularly admire your snappy little introductions for all the characters that you present in your book, who are all very nicely photographed in black and white by your good self as well. What a talented man you are. But perhaps could you give us a short reading, and then I think we'll go to a piece of music.
Okay, this is from Mordechai Tzanin. The Pope may speak Hebrew, but he will not be a Jew. In the early days of the Israeli state, the hegemony of Hebrew as lingua franca of the infant state was by no means assured. The overwhelming majority of diaspora Jews spoke Yiddish, a proud ghetto language. Its idiom was proletarian and non-assimilationist. Worse, from the point of view of state bureaucrats, Yiddish had been championed by the socialist and fiercely anti-Zionist Bund and was associated with a philosophy of doikait, or fighting anti-Semitism in the places where Jews lived. When Ruska Korchak, a heroine of the Vilna Partisans, spoke of her experiences in Yiddish to a Histadrut convention in January 1945, David Ben-Gurion followed her with the words, "Despite the fact that the previous speaker spoke in a foreign and grating language," he was prevented from finishing his speech by outrage in the auditorium. A conventional wisdom began to evolve in which Yiddish was a perverted language, reflecting the perversion of the soul of the diaspora Jew. The revulsion from it was a recoil from diaspora existence. By the early 1950s, the Jewish state was using police officers and thugs to enforce a ban on Yiddish theatre and daily newspapers. In the years that followed, Zionist enthusiasts and ambassadors would do everything in their power to make Hebrew and not Yiddish the second language of the diaspora. Mordechai Tzanin, a boyish 98-year-old, when interviewed, was the editor of Israel's first Yiddish newspaper.
Great. Thanks very much.
Dear The Observer magazine, I have had a constant ambition over the last 2 years to insert an Apple iPod into a bowl of tomato soup. I would very much appreciate it if you are able to assist me with funds to purchase such a device and to...
An evening walk at the horizon, walk with killers,
a long, rough-hewn path. The many lives have trod, although not alone, where the rocks are lost, a soft suffering under moss, a scream at the horizon in a paper dust, a pink sky. For we know that nothing's no good now. The details of this scene are scattered on the ground. The west is the blue over Baku's head to the east. A pink skies, pink skies, pink skies. Pink skies, pink skies, pink skies.
Just a quick announcement to say that this evening at 9 o'clock at the Square in 21 Russell Square on the northwest side, there's going to be a benefit for Anarchists Against the Wall. It's the after launch party for the book Occupied Minds that I was just talking about. There'll be a screening of the unmissable Palestinian film Paradise Now, which is absolutely fantastic. Everyone should see it. There'll be speakers, a West Bank photo exhibition, and DJs, including Tanya, who played at Rampart at Punk Purim.
Great. Thanks very much, Arthur. Last weekend was the 11th anniversary of the Schengen Information System, SIS, going live in Europe. Big deal, I hear you say. And what is it anyway? Basically, it's the Europe-wide Big Brother computer system set up to link national databases and allow different countries' police to share information about undesirables. It developed from the Schengen Convention, established during the mid-80s, which created a new zone of cooperative nation-states and lifted border controls within large swathes of Europe, basically the EU countries plus Norway, Iceland and Switzerland, but excluding the UK and Ireland. Part of the agreement which has established SIS, known as Article 96, was that it was to protect the member countries from threatening non-nationals from outside the region. Bad enough, but at least it's only supposed to be used against non-Europeans. Well, not so in fact. Several reports around large anti-globalisation protests have recorded how activists from EU countries have been denied entry to other EU countries ahead of protests. Requests made under Freedom of Information Acts reveal that in 2003, a total of 503 EU citizens had their details put into the SIS database. But information about the EU subversives has been recorded as not known. I apologise. What information about the EU subversives has been recorded is not known, but reasons can be easily found to fit the woolly criteria needed. These include undesirable on the territory of a participating state or suspected of taking part in serious offences and having to be the subject of checks or control. Not that we're suggesting there's been any over-political interpretation of who constitutes a danger to society, of course, but top of the Big Brother pops was Switzerland, with 389 registered. And of course, Switzerland just happens to have been the location of the Davos World Economic Forums and scene of many anti-globalisation protests over the last 6 years. Could these facts be related, one wonders. So instead of passport control, we get millions of secret intelligence computer records based on suspicion and prejudice. The latest news is they're planning an updated, more powerful SIS2 database. With the rise of biometric passports and the ID card scheme, it doesn't take a genius to work out that Big Brother just keeps getting bigger and bigger.
Following last week's report on campaigns for water rights, there's some good news this week. Schnooze reports that more companies are quitting the water privatisation game as increasing numbers of people revolt against having to pay more and more money for less and less water. As Thames Water leaves Shanghai for pastures new, people across the globe are wondering where their money has gone. Despite investments of £14 billion between 1990 and 1997, most of this cash has ended up in richer countries. Thirsty Sub-Saharan Africa has received less than 1% of all the money invested in water supplies by private companies in the last 10 years. Last week, Suez, one of the world's largest PLC barons, water PLC barons, said that it was now impossible for it to work in Latin America because the irresponsible and restless natives were trying to seize back control of their water supply. As we reported last week, campaigners estimate that 6,000 children die every day as a result of poor water and sanitation. Last Wednesday, the 22nd of March, was World Water Day. It was marked with demonstrations across the world against privatisation and wastage, which is sure to keep up the pressure on the water companies. For more, see wdm.org.uk.
Rossport Solidarity Camp in Northwest Mayo has recently reopened in a new location along the planned route of Shell's dangerous experimental pipeline in a beautiful windswept part of rural Mayo, Ireland. Last year, five local men were jailed indefinitely at the behest of Shell, who were trying to put an end to the blockading of the construction site. After 3 months, and no drop in the spirits of the continuing local protests, backed up by support from visiting activists, Shell stopped work for the winter. The men were then released, and campaigners have now regrouped. The camp is back, and locals and activists are preparing for the upcoming fight, with campaigners saying construction may begin any day now. The pipeline is proposed to run at an experimentally high pressure on unstable bogland with a history of landslides and subsidence. The pipe also runs through the backyards of locals living as close as 50 metres to the pipeline, despite the safe zone for the pipeline being at least 300 metres. As one of the campaigners said, if Shell thought that small farmers in the arse end of nowhere would be a pushover, they thought wrong. When we say this thing will be built over our dead bodies, we mean it. For more, see struggle.ws. And now we play out with a piece from an American radio show similar to this one, which has outlines the case for the impeachment of the George Bush administration.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive magazine, which you can find at our website, progressive.org. I want to talk to you about an issue that's crucial to the very survival of our democracy, and that's the impeachment of George W. Bush. He and his administration have been so brazen in violating the law and in asserting monarchical powers that we as American citizens must take the extraordinary step to impeach him from office, to reassert our rights, to reset the system of checks and balances, and to reaffirm our democracy. We need to protest Bush's illegal actions, and we need to use the only tool that the Constitution provides, and that's impeachment. Article 2, Section 4 states, "The President, Vice President, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors." I'd like to make a couple points on this. First, notice that the Vice President is specifically named. So while we're advocating the impeachment of George W. Bush, we shouldn't stop there. We should impeach Dick Cheney, too, for Cheney's been in on every illegal act that Bush has committed. Indeed, to really understand what's happened to this country over the last 5 years, we probably ought to view this as the second term of the Cheney administration, since Bush is largely a front man. I imagine that right after Cheney scoured the land looking for the best vice presidential candidate and then gazed into the mirror and chose himself, that he told Bush, "All you need to do is to give a speech or two every day, and then you can go out jogging or ride a bike or clear brush or lift weights, and I'll do the heavy lifting of governance." The second point on Article 2, Section 4 is that clause, "other high crimes and misdemeanors." Originally, at the Constitutional Convention, the drafters had restricted impeachment to just treason and bribery. But George Mason, with Madison and Hamilton agreeing, argued that a president could commit other egregious abuses of power that had nothing to do with taking money under the table or working for a foreign government. Mason said there must be a phrase that would encompass attempts to subvert the Constitution, and so the founders settled on high crimes and misdemeanors. And that's exactly what George W. Bush has been doing. He's been subverting our Constitution, and he's repeatedly violated his oath of office to faithfully execute his duties and to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. He's done so in four key areas: in the Iraq War, in the detentions here at home and abroad, in the torture scandal, and in the NSA warrantless spying program. First, Iraq. Bush's war was a war of aggression, prohibited by the UN Charter. Article 2 of that charter says that all members shall refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state. Article 51 provides an exception for self-defense, but only if an armed attack has already occurred against that state. Now, Saddam Hussein had not attacked the United States. International law also provides an exception for imminence if you're just about to be attacked. But Saddam Hussein was not about to attack the United States. By waging this aggressive war, which was deemed a war crime at Nuremberg, Bush was violating the UN Charter, as Kofi Annan himself has acknowledged. And by violating the UN Charter, Bush was violating Article 6 of the Constitution, which says that treaties are the supreme law of the land. But even beyond this, the way that Bush dragged the country into war on a leash of lies is too an impeachable offense. There can hardly be a more grave act imaginable than to dupe a democracy into going to war. But that is what Bush has done, as the Downing Street memos clearly indicate. On July 20th, 2002, many months before Bush launched the war, Richard Dearlove, head of British intelligence, met with George Tenet, director of the CIA. After that meeting, Dearlove reported back that Bush was intent on war. His findings were reflected in the July 23, 2002 memo to Prime Minister Tony Blair, which said military action was now seen as inevitable. Bush wanted to remove Saddam through military action, justified by the conjunction of terrorism and WMD, but the intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy. To fix the intelligence and the facts is to engage in a fraud against the U.S. government and the American public. And Cheney and Bush et al. Proceeded to do so. According to a report by House Democratic staff, they made at least 237 misleading public statements. Here are two of the biggest whoppers. Just days before Bush ignited the war, Cheney went on Meet the Press and said, "We believe Saddam has, in fact, reconstituted nuclear weapons." And in Bush's address to the nation on March 17, 2003, he said there was no doubt that the Iraq regime continues to possess and conceal some of the most lethal weapons ever devised. Remember, this was after the UN weapons inspectors had been scouring Iraq for evidence of those weapons and had found absolutely nothing. In fact, Mohammed el-Baradei, who just got the Nobel Peace Prize, had told the Security Council weeks before that not only did Saddam not have any nuclear weapons, there was no evidence that he had even reconstituted his nuclear weapons program. Bush and Cheney were engaging in an elaborate fraud and in a conspiracy to commit fraud, as Lewis Lapham of Harper's has pointed out. Lapham also cites the Supreme Court in Hammerschmidt versus the United States. It says someone commits fraud against the U.S. when he obstructs lawful government functions by deceit, craft, or trickery, or at least by means that are dishonest. No one can engage in misrepresentation, chicanery, or other overreaching to defeat legitimate official action and purpose, according to that Supreme Court decision. But that fits Bush and Cheney to a T. The second ground for impeachment is Bush's illegal detentions in the United States and abroad. After 9/11, during the Ashcroft raids, thousands of Arabs and Muslims were rounded up here and incarcerated for months. They had no access to lawyers, no access to their family members, who didn't even know where they were. Many were held in awful conditions and in solitary confinement. Some were beaten and abused. As the Center for Constitutional Rights has noted in its new book, Articles of Impeachment Against George W. Bush, any person detained by the government must be brought before a magistrate judge within 48 hours so that the appropriateness of their detention may be reviewed. The administration violated the law, failing to bring detainees before a judge for weeks and months. This not only violated the rights of the detainees, it also grossly violated basic separation of powers principles by denying the judiciary any opportunity to review thousands of detentions, the center notes. Then there's Yasser Hamdi and Jose Padilla, the two U.S. citizens seized by the Bush administration, denied their due process rights, denied access to their attorneys, and kept in military brigs for more than 2 years, mostly in solitary confinement. In a disgusting rationale, the Bush administration even told the Supreme Court that it was holding them for humanitarian purposes. These are U.S. citizens who were denied their most basic rights under the 5th, 6th, and 14th Amendments by orders of the President of the United States. The Supreme Court eventually ruled in the Hamdi case that a state of war is not a blank check for the president when it comes to the rights of the nation's citizens. But Bush has been acting like he had that blank check ever since 9/11, and he fills it in at will. Mass detentions at Guantanamo and in Iraq and in Afghanistan also are impeachable offenses. The Bush administration has rounded up thousands of people and is holding them indefinitely and without charges and without access to any court anywhere. According to James Risen's State of War, the Bush administration intends to hold some of these detainees without charge for the rest of their lives. This is a blatant violation, yet again, of the Geneva Conventions. The third major ground for impeachment is the torture scandal itself. George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, and Donald Rumsfeld have repeatedly violated international treaties, U.S. statutes against torture and war crimes, and the Eighth Amendment by countenancing torture at Guantanamo, in Iraq, and at Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan. At Guantanamo, prisoners have been beaten. They've had lit cigarettes put out in their ears. They've had to endure false executions and sensory deprivation. And when some of them went on hunger strike to protest their treatment, they were forced into restraint chairs where guards shoved feeding tubes repeatedly up their noses until they bled. And they were then confined in those restraint chairs until they defecated and urinated on themselves. In Iraq, well, we all saw the photos at Abu Ghraib. But the hooding and the shackling and the dangling of prisoners by their arms occurred not only at Abu Ghraib, but in many other places in Iraq. That was standard operating procedure. So was forced nakedness. So, for a time, was the use of unmuzzled dogs. In Afghanistan, on top of all of these brutalities, detainees were beaten, kept naked, and cold, and doused with freezing water. At least two detainees at Bagram were murdered there by U.S. guards. And they're not the only ones. This torture scandal is also a murder scandal. According to the Pentagon itself, there have been 34 cases of suspected or confirmed homicides by U.S. personnel of detainees. The lawyers group, Human Rights First, has identified another 11 in which the facts suggest death as a result of physical abuse or harsh conditions of detention. That's 45 suspected or confirmed murders of prisoners in U.S. custody by U.S. personnel. If that doesn't appall you, I don't know what will. Maybe the export of detainees for torture? Because the CIA has been doing that too, nabbing people and flying them out to a country that's notorious for torture. So what's Bush's responsibility for all this? He conveyed by word and by deed that the laws and treaties against torture need not be followed, as did his vice president and his secretary of defense. On the evening of September 11th, Bush told his counterterrorism staff, according to Richard Clark, that any barriers in your way, they're gone. And he said, I don't care what the international lawyers say, we're going to kick some ass. He also authorized the CIA to send detainees to third countries for torture, and he let George Tenet know that the gloves are now off. Bush even complained to Tenet that he was being too gentle on a prisoner who was badly wounded and on pain medication. Bush said, who authorized putting him on pain medication? This, according to James Risen of the New York Times. Bush also notoriously exempted the Taliban and Al-Qaeda from protections under the Geneva Conventions, and it's not up to the president to decide who is and who is not covered by those conventions, which cover all persons. Cheney has been even more blunt. After 9/11, he told Tim Russert on Meet the Press that we have to work sort of the dark side. And more recently, he lobbied Capitol Hill for the right to torture. Rumsfeld's culpable as well. He sent out a directive on December 2, 2002, instructing subordinates in interrogation techniques that breach the Geneva Conventions, including using detainees' individual phobias such as use of dogs to induce stress. 6 weeks later, he rescinded this memo, but according to the New Yorker, he proceeded to approve many of the same techniques. Rumsfeld also has admitted to keeping an Iraqi detainee from the International Red Cross. The U.S. government has a policy of holding such ghost detainees, a policy that Rumsfeld and Tenet approved. And for 2 years, the Justice Department asserted in its Bybee memo that all interrogation was legal that did not result in organ failure or death, and even then, the torturer could get off if he said he didn't intend to have such results. This torture scandal has done much to tarnish the reputation of the United States abroad, but it also gets at the central question of whether here at home, a president is above the law. This question rises to its greatest heights in the NSA warrantless spying program. Here, the law couldn't be clearer. The FISA Act explicitly states that the exclusive means for spying on U.S. citizens is by getting a warrant from the FISA court. Bush claims he doesn't need to do that. He is thereby violating the FISA Act and the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. As John Dean of Watergate fame said, Bush is the first president to admit to an impeachable offense. This is not a partisan issue. Bruce Fein, Associate Deputy Attorney General in the Reagan administration, said the unapologetic assertion by Bush that he has the right to continue with this warrantless spying is an impeachable offense. It jeopardizes our democratic dispensation and civil liberties for the ages, he said. Norm Ornstein of the conservative American Enterprise Institute said, this really is the kind of thing that Alexander Hamilton was referring to when impeachment was discussed. They're right. The NSA scandal and the other egregious abuses by President Bush represent a grave threat to our liberties and to our system of checks and balances. Now, a lot of people think even talking about impeachment is silly. They say it's not going to happen. But few people thought Nixon would be impeached after he won re-election by a landslide in 1972. And even though the mainstream media isn't paying attention, people at the grassroots are in favor of impeachment. According to a Zogby poll, 53% of Americans would favor impeachment if it could be shown that Bush lied about the reasons for going to war, and 52% favor impeachment if it can be shown that Bush illegally spied on American citizens. Right now, John Conyers, the great congressman from Detroit, has introduced a bill to explore grounds for impeachment. It already has 25 co-sponsors. As more revelations come out, especially on the illegal spying that Bush has been engaged in, the number of co-sponsors will rise. And as more and more of us press for impeachment from below, the number of co-sponsors will rise. And if the Democrats gain control of the House in November, Conyers will become chair of the Judiciary Committee, whose job it is to draft bills of impeachment. The Bush administration has pushed this country halfway down the cliff to a scary form of government that's antithetical to democracy and to the wishes of our founders. We must use the only rope and ladder the Constitution provides us to climb up that cliff to safety, and that's impeachment. The Supreme Court back in 1866 warned of this current situation. In Ex parte Milligan, it said, the Constitution of the United States is a law for rulers and people, equally in war and in peace, and covers with the shield of its protection all classes of men, at all times and under all circumstances. No doctrine involving more pernicious consequences was ever invented by the wit of man than that any of its provisions can be suspended during any of the great exigencies of government. Such a doctrine, said the court, leads directly to anarchy or despotism. Bush acts like a despot. We can't let him get away with it. We can't let him continue to disgrace the office of the presidency, violate his oath of office, and trample on our Constitution. We must demand impeachment. We must demand impeachment now. Thanks for listening to me. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive. For more information, please visit our website.
For the last hour, you were listening to Indie Media. Sorry, frog in my throat. And Grounds for Impeachment, a lecture by Matt Rothschild. I'll need to cough again.